This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 11 of Metatrex, Trek FM's show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Zachary Frueling, and with me today is Mike Morrison. In this episode, we'll be discussing artificial intelligence, which is the problem of whether computers or other constructed non-biological beings can think. And we're going to look at the episode from TNG, The Quality of Life. And so, Mike, welcome to the show tonight. I thought you might want to start us off with a hello and a quick synopsis of TNG, The Quality of Life.
Yeah, thank you, Zachary. Yeah, we're going to jump right in and talk about the quality of life. As you and I talked about in the turbo lift up here, this isn't the most exciting episode of TNG, but it does raise some very interesting questions. And we felt like it would be a good next step from our last podcast, where we talked a little bit about emerging intelligence and thought this would be a logical next step. So The Quality of Life is a sixth season episode of The Next Generation. Geordi is assigned to survey a new mining development where it has been discovered that Dr. Farallon has invented a tool or several tools to perform maintenance tasks at this mining development. But during a small emergency, the exocomps, as they are come to be called, exhibit certain behaviors that lead Data to believe that they have developed intelligence and that they are emerging beings. And so he advocates on behalf of the exocomps with both Dr. Farallon and, of course, Jean-Luc Picard, to recognize their rights and to grant them the same privilege that would be granted any intelligent life form.
Well, honestly, Mike, this isn't one of my favorite TNG episodes. I had to remind myself which season it's in. I've passed it by on my rewatches many times. It's one of the ones I tend to skip right over. You know, I even had to remind myself of the title. I'm usually pretty good at remembering the titles of the TNG episodes. But this one, I was thinking, you know, Quality of Life, which one is that? Oh, that's the one with the little robots. That's right. And they look like, you know, droids from Star Wars, or they look like the bots from Mystery Science Theater 3000 or something, you know. So it's not one of my favorite episodes, but I love the question of artificial intelligence. It is an excellent segue from our discussion we had last time on the problem of the external world, and it's related because of the question of skepticism of other minds. Even when you're talking about people, there's a question of how you really know that other people aren't just holograms or aren't just computer simulations, right? We talked about this last time in episode 10, and this is an extension of that. And of it, just like if I want to be sure that you, for example, are really a person and really conscious, you know, I might have a bunch of criteria in mind that I might use to evaluate whether you're a person, and I can apply those same criteria to an android or to a robot and ask the same question about the consciousness of machine intelligence. So it's a really interesting episode, and I think I like the fact that the robots in this question, the exocomps, don't have a human form factor. They're not androids like Data. And part of the reason I think that works in this episode is sometimes that human form factor sways your emotions one way or the other. Like Data, you can feel Data emoting whether or not you think that he's conscious, right?
Right.
He has the behaviors that tend to pull human emotions a certain direction, and that works as a plot device. And of course, it's interesting from a philosophical standpoint to ask about whether Data is conscious. But you know, if you strip all that away, that's something this episode is trying to do, is stripping away the non-essential factors, so you can get right down to the question of machine intelligence and machine consciousness, dealing with these fairly abstract exocomp devices rather than a being like Data that can pull your heartstrings one way or the other.
Yeah, they sort of remind me of bulky Roombas.
Yeah, they're gonna, you know, if they need a vacuum on the USS Enterprise, the USS Hilton, they just bust out the exocomps, right?
Just bust them out,
right?
And they, you know, they get a little vacuum attachment on the front, and you know, they go to work.
Yeah, the exocomp house cleaning service.
I think it could work.
Yeah, I can picture Data advocating for fair pay for exocomps.
I can see him picketing.
Fair, yeah, just, you know, fair play for Cuba, fair play for exocomps, right?
Nice. I'm disappointed that they didn't make a comeback in season 7, or we didn't see them later on, developing a culture of their own, and we didn't put them on a planet, we didn't seed them somewhere so that they could, you know, be fruitful and multiply. I'm just slightly disappointed in that.
Well, this episode is you know, really related to that that Voyager episode where there's the intelligent weapon of mass destruction.
Yes.
I forget the name of the episode. I wish I had an episode list here. Do you remember the name of the episode, Mike? Warhead. Is that the name of the episode, Warhead?
Yeah, Warhead. I think that's Voyager Season 5.
Yep, that sounds right. So, you know, this is really, you know, we do get a sequel. They're exocomps with guns, essentially. So,
actually, Zachary, I was really surprised when we began talking about this. I thought to myself, you know, how many, just off the top of my head, Star Trek episodes I could think of that obviously dealt with artificial intelligence in some form or fashion. And I was really surprised at the number of Star Trek episodes. It just, again, off the top of my head. Of course, I think Data probably comes to mind first when we think about artificial intelligence in the Star Trek universe. But you're absolutely right, and you raise a great point. You know, Data has that humanoid form, and it's very easy for us to, surprisingly enough, become emotionally engaged in his journey to become more human. And, you know, certainly when we sit down and we think about, you know, how they fought to, you know, to afford him the same rights as any Starfleet officer, and, you know, recognize him as, you know, truly a unique life form, we kind of take that journey with him. But here we're dealing with something that doesn't have that humanoid form or fashion, and we see that played out in several episodes of Star Trek, and we'll get into some of those as well as we go along.
So I was wondering, Mike, you said you put together a list of episodes of Star Trek that have artificial intelligence at issue. Can you kind of divide these up into sort of different families of types of episodes? So you've got, you know, episodes dealing with androids, you've got episodes dealing with holograms, you've got these non-humanoid, you know, robot-like entities. Any other sort of categories of artificial intelligence in Star Trek?
Well, I can take a look at the list real quick and share it with our listeners. And again, this isn't, I didn't really put a lot of research or time into this. This is just a few episodes that popped off the top of my head when I thought about artificial intelligence. I think about, obviously, the first one that comes to my mind, Return of the Archons, Landru in the original series, season 1. I think about Dead Stop from Enterprise. Dreadnought from Voyager, Warhead, I have already mentioned, from season 5 of Voyager. Later on in season 7 of The Next Generation, the episode Emergence, where the ship's computer begins to develop, you know, qualities of life.
Real quick, let's pause on that one for just a second. But that's an interesting contrast to this episode, because even though at the beginning of The Quality of Life, no one is really sympathizing with the exocomps except for Data, and by the end, you know, I think people have at least recognized their sentience if they aren't moved by that in some way. And when the Enterprise computer becomes self-aware, I don't think it gets that sort of sympathy of being alive. You know, this episode's interesting because it conflates the issue of consciousness with the issue of being alive. And Data mm-hmm. always frames it in terms of the exocomps being alive now. And you just don't see that when they're talking about the Enterprise computer, right? You know, there's no question whether the computer has all of a sudden become a life form.
Right, right.
So I'm curious what accounts for the difference between that episode and what we see in the quality of life.
Well, you know, it's funny because one of the ways that we recognize that the ship's computer is manifesting the signs and symptoms of life, obviously, because it takes control of the holodeck and begins to simulate or manifest itself in holodeck characters. So, you know, obviously it's a plot point in order to engage us in the plight of the computer, but you're right in that we see, a greater concern, I think, given early on in that episode for what everyone needs to do in order to allow that life form to emerge and become more self-aware.
Mm-hmm. But you don't see them, being tempted to, dismantle the Enterprise computer or disconnect it from the ship because it's something like slave labor, right? Like you see with the exocomps.
Right. Yeah, and there wasn't a... I'm just waiting for, Riker and Picard to go, we're going to destroy the ship. I'm going to start the self-destruct sequence. We can't let this life form have. I mean, that's what you might have expected. I mean, if any alien life form were to gain control of the ship, Riker and Picard would have gone straight to the panel and begun the self-destruct sequence. I never for the life of me could figure out why they didn't take that course of action.
It strikes me that you can see the evolution of the writing and the thinking of the writers and producers of Star Trek over the years from this episode in TNG, where they're starting to play with the notions of artificial intelligence or machine intelligence. In fact, there's this episode, TNG, The Quality of Life, but just a couple of episodes after that, you get Ship in a Bottle, where you get the consciousness of Moriarty on the holodeck.
The Return of Moriarty.
Yeah, just a couple of episodes right after this. So you can see that the writers are playing with this idea. And then, as you get into Voyager, you start getting into some of the ethical issues, like, can we manufacture holograms and treat them as slave labor? Is there some ethical issue against that? And, to their credit, you can see, the baby steps of playing with those deeper ethical ideas in this episode. But they're going to sort of take it to the max, in later episodes in Voyager dealing with the Doctor and holographic rights.
Well, you think about how far they come. I mentioned Return of the Archons, and that was one of probably three really great artificial intelligence episodes in the original series. Mm-hmm. And interestingly enough, all of them ended in Kirk basically outsmarting the computer and causing it, or rather talking it into destroying itself. The Ultimate Computer, mm-hmm. which is very similar to Emergence that we were just talking about, where the M5 computer is installed onto Enterprise and exhibits, those signs and symptoms of being emerging artificial life. Kirk just basically outwitted it and talked it into destroying itself. And then we go all the way to, the Doctor in Voyager, Photons Be Free. Mm-hmm. So you're right. It is interesting how over the course of, we'll just say 50 years of Star Trek, how our point of view when it comes to artificial intelligence has changed, has evolved.
See, now I'm sort of envisioning a mashup of that episode of Voyager where a member of the Q Continuum wants to commit suicide.
Yes.
Combine that with an episode on the exocomps where just out of the sheer existential tedium of having to work in a mine all day, the exocomps, rather than just shutting themselves down, they just commit suicide right there in the mine shaft. Episode over.
Goodbye, cruel world.
Goodbye, cruel. And just leave it at that. They couldn't deal with it, so problem goes away.
Yeah.
That's one way to solve the ethical dilemma, right? Just let the exocomps commit suicide.
Captain Kirk could be like, yes.
So, you know, undoubtedly Star Trek plays with this idea in several ways. And like I said, I think you can see an evolution of the thinking about artificial intelligence and examining progressively deeper issues as Star Trek moves on. Right. You can only tell this story so many ways, right? You can ask the question, whether is Data conscious? You can ask the question, is the Enterprise computer conscious? Are holograms conscious? Are exocomps conscious? So they're forced to tell the story in different ways, which they do. But, you know, fundamentally, the philosophical question is largely the same. You know, what criteria could we use to decide whether a machine or a robot or an android or a hologram is conscious? Is there some sort of test or criteria we can use to settle the issue one way or the other? You know, we might have intuitions. And I think, like with Data, you get strong intuitions largely because he's an android and has the human form factor. And you sympathize with Data and you empathize with him as you can see the development of his character and the development of during his quest to be more human. You go along with him on the journey. And so you start to have feelings for Data. But that doesn't answer the question philosophically, right? And I don't think anyone I've talked to here on Trek FM is of the theory that Data is just a machine. But you want to dig a little deeper and ask, well, what criteria can you give to decide for sure whether Data is not just a machine, or in this case, the exocomps? You know, what when Data starts examining the exocomps and testing his theory that they might be alive, he tries to give them a test, right? He sets up an experiment, sets up some conditions, and tries to see whether the exocomps will continue to act out of their own self-preservation in the context of this test. And he has some assumptions about what it means to be alive, one of which is the idea of self-preservation. These exocomps seem to demonstrate self-preservation behavior, and Data is using that as a strong earmark for if not consciousness, then life in general, the instinct for self-preservation. But if you know, that's, and it's fun to, in the episode, you can see the characters sort of play with this idea. Data is asking the question of Dr. Crusher, what does it mean to be alive? What's the definition of life? And she gives a really textbooky response, like she's reading out of the Encyclopedia Galactica, not the Britannica.
Actually, I thought her answer stunk, you know, because Data asked the question. He says, I'm curious as to what transpired between the moment that I was nothing more than an assemblage of parts in Dr. Soong's laboratory and the next moment when I became alive. He said, what is it that endowed me with life? And Dr. Crusher basically says to him, well, you know, it's funny, Data. Wesley asked the same question. And it's like such a lame answer. And basically says, you know, I think we struggle all our lives to answer the question. It's the typical, I hate to say it, it's a typical philosophical answer. You can ask the question, Data, but I don't think there is an answer. No, she says, I'm saying that we struggle our lives to answer it. It's a struggle that's important. That's what helps us to define our place in the universe. She says, you know, philosophers and theologians, scientists, they've been grappling with the question for centuries without ever coming to any conclusion. And I don't know that is that was such a great answer.
No, I think that answer is actually a little frustrating for me because it's hard for me to turn off my philosophical instinct to make distinctions, right? So I in that dialogue, I hear a bunch of things being conflated. You know, the question of consciousness being conflated with the definition of life in some sort of biological sense. And there's really just kind of a wishy-washiness of the terminology in this episode. And frankly, Dr. Crusher, you know, while she's one of my favorite characters in Star Trek, I love the Doctor. You know, I like the blue shirts. She's not the greatest philosopher, I think. So she's not going to give a philosophical answer. You know, she's giving the only answer she knows how to give, which is I don't really know. And, you know, I had to be a parent. And so I had to try to answer that question for Wesley. And we didn't come up with anything either, just like the 2000 years of, you know, philosophers asking that question. So,
I mean, it's essentially the same question. You know, a boy says to his mother, you know, where do babies come from? Or, you know, where do I come from? And so, you know, I think one of the jobs of a parent is to try to help their children answer that question in more than just a textbook biological sense. And so, you know, what am I doing here in the world? That's one of the big questions I think we all, and again, I think a good parent will do everything in their power to help their children answer that question. Data's question is very similar in that I think it's a question of purpose. I think it's a question of origins, but I think that there is more that could be said rather than the non-answer that Dr. Crusher gave. In fact, that's probably one of the shortcomings of this episode, Zachary, is, you know, it's obvious to me that I don't think it was written from a philosophical perspective, even though it's asking and trying to answer really one of the great philosophical questions.
Well, the thing that frustrates me is just the conflation of the two, what in my mind, what are two totally separate questions, right? Data comes along and asks the doctor, you know, what's the definition of life and are these exocomps alive? And, you know, that could mean two different things. One answer to that, one interpretation of that question is, are these machine things conscious? You know, do they have a mind? Can they think and reason? And maybe do they have emotions? Do they have this mental life, just like we think of biological beings like us having a life? And then there's the question of the sort of biological livingness, right? You know, are they alive in some sort of biological sense? All the chemical processes whatever's involved in the definition of life, right? All the things that Dr. Crusher gives are essentially biological processes, right? They reproduce and they respond to stimuli. And I forget the whole list of criteria that Dr. Crusher gives, but those strike me as sort of biological criteria rather than mental criteria. And in my mind, those are just two separate questions, right? You can imagine a machine that's intelligent that it wouldn't make sense to call that machine alive. And I think the exocomps go in that category, right? Even if the exocomps are conscious in some way, that is, if they have minds, if they're sentient or self-aware, that doesn't make them a biological life form in any meaningful sense. And what's different about Data in this regard is that Data has some of these biological processes replicated, right? He's fully functional, to use that joke again, right? He has simulated biological processes. He blinks and he can simulate eating and drinking, and he can he has fluids inside of him. So there is this sort of, if it's not genuine biology, it's at least a strong simulation of biology. And so we're more likely to call Data a life form because there's some replication of the biological in Data. You just don't see that with the exocomps. So in my mind, it just seems like a really easy question to answer. Like, okay, we can ask the interesting philosophical question about artificial intelligence and whether the exocomps are self-aware, and probably just set aside all the biological life form components that don't really apply to the exocomps. It just seems obvious to me that they don't apply.
Again, going back to I think some of the weakness in the writing, there's a conversation that happens at near the end of the episode between Data and Captain Picard. And, you know, Data says to Captain Picard, he said, you know, I thought you might want to know why I was willing to sacrifice your life to save several tiny little machines.
It's like, yeah, I do want to know the answer to that, Data.
And, you know, Captain Picard says to him, he says, I think I understand the predicament you're in. You know, that could not have been an easy choice. it's much more enlightened response than I probably would have given to Data. Data says, you know, it really wasn't. He said, you know, basically when my own status as a living thing was being questioned, you know, you went to bat for me. You fought to, you know, protect my rights, he said. And, I was really grateful for that. These little exocomps didn't really have an advocate like that. And he said, if I hadn't acted on their behalf, they would have been destroyed. He said, I couldn't allow that to happen. And again, I don't think the writing there did justice to what I think they were trying to accomplish in this episode.
Well, you know, there's a thread there that you're picking up on that I think is important, and it's kind of an interesting dovetail into the next topic on our discussion for tonight. We wanted to talk about the Turing test, Alan Turing's attempt to try to give some criteria for deciding whether a machine is intelligent or not. And this episode actually tries to do that in some ways. And I think one thread that I don't think gets a lot of attention in this episode is the discussion about growing a beard at the beginning of the episode. It seems so dovetailed in there. Right. You know, why are they playing poker and talking about growing a beard? And then they shift to this, you know, the A plot about the exocomps and all the drama that ensues there. I think there's a connection there. And the connection that I'm seeing is the spontaneity of deciding to grow a beard, right? There, you know, life forms like human males sometimes decide to grow beards, right? And there's a spontaneity to that you can't always explain. Like, you know, why do you want to grow a beard this week, Jordy? You've never done that before, and now you've decided to grow a beard. That's odd. And he can't really give an answer. They hem and haw a little bit and say, you know, there's this proud tradition of growing beards and whatnot. But frankly, he just did it because he wanted to. and that spontaneity is an essential part of being human, if not being conscious, right? Human for sure. And whether spontaneity is a hallmark of self-awareness, I don't know. But it's definitely a mark of being human. And you can try to take a list of all the things that it means to be human. I think you'd have spontaneity on the list. So this episode is actually, I think, playing with this idea of, like, you know, these are just human guys and they grow beards sometimes. And, you know, contrast that with these robots that are programmable. And there is a contrast there. And I think it gets a little lost because the exocomps get all the attention. But that's the connection I see with the beard growing at the beginning, that, you know, that spontaneity is an essential part of a human life. And, you know, as we begin to build a list of what criteria we might use to decide whether a machine is intelligent, I think spontaneity would have to go on the list.
I think, Zachary, I think you're right on. I think you're spot on in your analysis of that. I think it was in the freedom to choose. And I love that. I love that whole conversation, by the way. And even on a superficial level, I've got a head full of useless knowledge, and a lot of it is Star Trek related. Mm-hmm. You know, we discover in that scene that the beard is a symbol of bravery for a Klingon. Mm-hmm. I think that's a great little tidbit that we learn about beards. And I think you're right. It was the freedom to choose for himself. You know, Geordi's decision, there was no real reason. He basically, if I can paraphrase, he said, basically, I'm doing it because I can.
Yeah, and I can relate to that. You know, about a few weeks ago, my wife went down to Los Angeles for a week for work. You know, our company shipped her down there to work at a store down there. And, you know, I decided to grow a goatee while she was gone. And that's just such a human thing to do. Like, you know, the cat's away, the mice will play, and you grow a goatee. You know, I wouldn't normally do that. But, you know, that spontaneity, and even a little rebelliousness, like, you know, I'm breaking the rules. I wouldn't, you know, society doesn't necessarily like some of these things, but I'm going to do it anyway because I can, and I'm human. And I think it's just such an important part of being human. And I like that they worked it into the episode when contrasting that with the exocomps that are becoming self-aware and then breaking the rules. They're not following orders. They're shutting themselves down and the like. You know, that is a type of spontaneity that is analogous to growing a goatee.
Yeah. And again, I'm the same way. I can relate to that. You know, I remember a little over 13 years ago when we were expecting my daughter, I decided to grow a goatee, kind of out of the blue. I mean, my entire adult life, I had, I'd kept my face clean, and just out of the blue for no real reason, I grew a goatee. And then I kept a goatee a few years ago. I began shaving my head because I'm a little thin on top. And so last Christmas, it was this time last year, I decided to give the head shaving a break, and I grew the rest of my beard out, and for no real reason. I just, it's something I felt to do. It felt like doing, and I had the freedom to do it. And I still, you know, I still have the hair and beard here a year later.
So, Mike, if the exocomps grew a goatee, if they replicated a goatee, would that have settled the issue then and there?
They actually do in the mirror universe, Zachary. That's how we know it's the mirror universe exocomps.
Evil exocomps with a goatee.
Evil exocomps. They have a goatee.
I love it. Replicating their own beards. I love it.
Yeah, you know, instead of replicating a tool out at the end of the, you know, exocomps.
Yeah, and at Christmas time, if they did that in Star Trek, they'd replicate a white beard and a Santa hat.
You know. There you go. You know, I do want to go on record as saying, though, I really like Geordi's beard, and I wish they would have kept it. But I'm sure much the same way that producers sit down and they go, okay, we have, you know, 4 male characters, 2 female characters. We can't add a third female character because that would change the
dynamic. Well, you can't have Beverly Grobeard.
You can't.
Right. So they kind of wrote themselves into a corner on that one.
Well, you know, they experimented with a, you know, they've got Will Riker, and when you have a Riker beard, I mean, no other beard is going to be adequate.
Absolutely. And it just
overshadows everybody else's
beard. I promise
beard.
We're going to talk about some philosophy here in a minute, but what makes Riker's beard really work is the way they sort of trim out the inside of it, you know, the top part of his beard, and kind of make that shapely.
Oh, that's what makes it so bad.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, on that note, let's do some actual philosophy.
I think it would have thrown the balance off in the entire series if Geordi would have been allowed to keep the beard. I think it worked. I just want to go on record as saying.
Yeah, and once in a great while you get Picard in a beard, or at least the beginnings of a beard, like when he's being tortured by the Cardassian, you know,
there are four lights and the beginnings of a beard.
Yep. Well, let's start talking about the Turing test. So I mentioned that earlier that Alan Turing tried to give some criteria for how you'd decide whether a machine was intelligent. And I think his intuition starts where a lot of our intuition would. You know, how do I know that people are intelligent? You know, when I encounter another individual, another person, whether it's in real life or even better, like if it's on a podcast like this where we're talking to each other over a machine, right? How do I know that you're a conscious living being and not just a computer simulation? Well, there are some criteria I think you could give. They might involve the spontaneity of your responses, the intelligence, the fact that you're inquisitive and ask questions that weren't prompted, right? These are things that are hallmarks of intelligent communication with living beings that have a some degree of spontaneity to them. And that's why I think the spontaneity at the beginning of the episode is really important. That just strikes me as such an important part of how we would distinguish merely a programmed machine from a machine that has risen above its programming and become self-aware and become spontaneous. That's one of the obvious giveaways, I think. And it's also one of the things that's hardest to simulate, right? You've seen over the years the evolution of these artificial, you know, pseudo artificially intelligent kind of beings. I'm thinking of like the old chat bots, like in the old AOL instant message days, you know, where you'd type into the little instant messenger window and you'd get a response back, and it would try to emulate real human responses. And after a while, you'd want to see if you can game the system. You know, like how you know, can I ask a trick question and get it to reveal that it's just a machine and not a real person after all. And it was remarkably hard to do because, you know, the programmers of these bots would kind of, you know, figure out a way to turn the conversation right back on right back to you in the form of asking questions. So mm-hmm. You might say, you know, chatbot, what do you think about, you know, some event in the news? You know, I don't know, what do you think about the Olympics next year, right? You know, it would go, what do you think about the Olympics next year? And turn it back to you and force you to keep prompting along. And after a while, you realize that it's just programmed to do that. Those aren't real questions, right? But that's basically the intuition that Alan Turing has, that it's the communication between beings that gives us the indication of whether that being is really a life form or really, really self-aware and really conscious. So this test came to be called the Turing test, and it's just the idea is that, you know, suppose you're sitting at a computer terminal, very much like chatting with someone on Instant Messenger, and you know, you're given an arbitrarily long period of time, and you can chat about anything you want. If the computer can effectively, if its responses are indistinguishable from a human's responses in the long term over some arbitrarily long period of time, then for all intents and purposes, we would say that machine is conscious and self-aware. But it all boils down to the fact that, you know, we need to be able to either distinguish between the responses of a genuine human and a mere machine, or fail to distinguish between the responses of an actual human and a self-aware machine that's doing it for Alan Turing. And so, you know, then it's interesting to try to go down the list. Go, what are the hallmarks of genuinely self-aware communication? The spontaneity is part of it, asking questions, you know, telling jokes, you know, you, whatever it is, you can go down the list and try to come up with a list of criteria. But that's called the Turing test, named after Alan Turing. You know, can that sort of blind communication where you're not able to see whether your communication partner is a person or a machine, mm-hmm. would that be adequate to distinguish you know, living self-aware being artificially intelligent beings from mere machines.
You know, it's interesting that you mention you know, the conversation bot, if you will, because we live in the age of Siri, or mm-hmm. you know, I have a deal, Cortana or something like that.
Is that Microsoft's version?
Microsoft's version of that.
Yeah.
So, and Siri, I'm probably most familiar with. And I think we've all been a little fascinated with it, and we've asked, you know, silly questions and try to, you know, trip it up and see what the response is.
Siri will even tell you a good night story if you want.
Siri will tell you a good night story. Siri FYI. Will call you anything you want to be called. If you don't like the, you know, the female voice, you can change it to a British male or, you know, whatever the heck. And so I think at one time, the idea of something being able to learn and adapt, I think, was more of a criteria when we're talking about, you know, what kind of tests to determine if something is genuinely thinking. Does it have the ability to learn and adapt? But here in, you know, 2000, almost 2016, when our listeners are listening to the podcast, you know, you're out there on the road today, and you pull over and you say, Siri, you know, can you find me some restaurants near here? Siri will find you restaurants. Siri will tell you a good night story. Siri will call you whatever. It learns and adapts. That's the algorithm that it's programmed with. It learns. I mean, you can program it to pull up your favorite restaurants. If you don't want just an exhaustive list of restaurants that are around you, it can learn what kinds of restaurants, what particular foods you're fond of, and that's the list that you get. So I think we can almost pull that one off the table, because we can take Zachary seemingly non-living entities, computer intelligence, and program it to learn and adapt.
You know, I love looking at things like that through a child's eyes, with like childlike wonder. You know, for us in our 30s and 40s, you know, I think we're a little more skeptical. Like, okay, we've seen this before, right? I talked with those chatbots back in the 90s, and now it's here it is with Siri, right? And they just have they've built a better mousetrap, built a smarter, more sophisticated. Toy essentially to play with, right? Mm-hmm. But I'm not tempted to think that Siri is conscious. But my sister has daughter who's now a year old, I think, give or take. And she knows how to talk to Siri, right? My sister can hand her the phone. She knows where to hit the button. She'll hold the button down, wait for Siri to say something, and then she'll mouth in 1 year old speak, right? It's not quite real language yet, but she'll kind of blabber at Siri and then wait for Siri to say something in response. And my niece just thinks this is the greatest thing she's ever seen. This will keep her busy for an hour. And it must be really interesting to grow up in a world like that, where, you know, talking to Siri from our point of view, being a little older and a little more jaded, and we've seen the bad examples of attempts to simulate consciousness and technology and all the gimmicks and whatnot. She doesn't have any of that. She just knows that her phone talks to her, right? And does that change the perception at all, or is that younger generation going to be more likely to believe that machines like that can speak and seem to learn and emulate human responses, that they're genuinely conscious? In other words, is the skepticism just sort of an old fuddy-duddy kind of skepticism? Or is there something to our skepticism? You know, I'm curious, because it seems like the state of technology has really changed. I'm not convinced I know what it's like to grow up in that environment where machines talk back.
Well, it's interesting that you raise that point. I think this is how, even now as a society, we've been able to push the limits of artificial intelligence, because every generation comes along where the preconceived notions of my generation or the generation before mine, those preconceived notions have been broken down. I mean, before me, we had, you know, Lost in Space, for instance, you know, something that I watched in reruns. And we think about the robot on Lost in Space, you know, danger, Will Robinson, danger. Mm-hmm. But interestingly enough, you know, looking at that now, you know, that robot seems pretty, honestly, pretty lame. Mm-hmm. It seems, very, very limited. And so those preconceived notions of that generation when Lost in Space was on television and the preconceived notions of, say, my daughter's generation now are so far removed, we can take an image like that and we can actually create that robot now. We can build that robot when it was science fiction before. Now it has become science fact. So mm-hmm. when we look at the exocomps here in the quality of life, we can look at those and say, well, you know, for a little bot to become, you know, a sentient being, that's so far-fetched. But, you know, you have my daughter's generation who just didn't have the same preconceived notions that I have. Mm-hmm. You know, her generation very, very well could put in production a truly intelligent life form, artificial life form, that can perform maintenance or maybe even have the ability to emerge and choose for itself what it will and will not do. And I think that's at the heart of this episode. It's this emerging life form that should, at least in the opinion of the writer, have the choice, the freedom to choose whether it lives, whether it dies, whether it works, whether it doesn't. You know, whether it generates a screwdriver on the front of it, or you know whether it's a hyperspanner. You know, it has the freedom to choose. Again, I think that's the center of this. Who knows what the next generation is going to be able to produce because those preconceived notions have been broken down.
Well, I think the question that the Turing test raises is an interesting one. It basically forces you to ask the question, as machines get more and more complex and as they simulate or at least exhibit the behavior of conscious life forms, whether it's the appearance of free choice or the appearance of consciousness, the appearance of inquisitiveness, the appearance of emotion, whatever. Mm-hmm. I think the question for me is the question of whether, you know, as machines get more and more complex, the question is whether that their complexity of behavior is just mere simulation, right? Are they merely simulating being conscious or simulating having emotions or simulating having free choice? Or do they genuinely have those properties? Are they beings like us that are self-aware and have a subjective experience to them? Or are they just merely increasingly sophisticated machines? And I think you just can't appeal to the behaviors themselves to answer that question, right? Because as machines get more complex, they're going to have all the behaviors you'd expect from a conscious living being. But if it's mere simulation, you just can't tell if that's real or not, right? Because the behaviors would be exactly the same. So I don't think you can appeal to the behaviors themselves to settle the issue.
Yeah, interestingly enough, going back to Dr. Crusher's answer to Data, she talked about consuming food. She talked about development. She talked about procreation. Those being functions of a living being. Those being criteria, if you will, to judge whether or not you know said being is truly alive. And of course, you know, in the Star Trek universe, we've already come to discover that we consider Data to be alive, and yet he does none of those things. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, Zachary. Does the Turing test does it change? Does it adapt? Because again, as you pointed out, and you're right on the money. I think as we go along, we're going to be able to develop better and better machines and simulate. I really believe that somewhere down the road, and I don't think it's too far down the road, we're going to be able to develop bots, androids, whatever you want to call them, that are going to be able to exhibit something that resembles a living being.
Yeah, and more importantly, there'll be beings that will pass the Turing test, right? There'll be beings that, you know, the average person won't be able to tell are a machine or a real person, whether through some sort of blind test like the actual Turing test, or you know, you see in science fiction, you see robots or androids that are so lifelike, you know, with the human form factor and all, such that you just can't tell whether they're a robot or a person, mm-hmm. right? I think you're right. I don't think we're too far from that. But again, I don't think the fact that a machine has passed the Turing test settles the philosophical question of whether that being is really conscious in some metaphysical sense, right? Or do they have these properties that we have of self-awareness and subjective experience? I don't see how you can, you know, it might be rational for us to conclude that based on the Turing machine, but I don't think it settles the question of whether that's true in fact.
Yeah. Yeah, indeed. Indeed. I think about, Hal from 2001, Space Odyssey. You know, here we, in essence, we have a deranged machine that goes into self-preservation mode and is willing to kill every human being on board in order to protect its own life.
But you hit the nail on the head there. There are things that Hal does in 2001: A Space Odyssey that aren't machine like, right? The notion of going insane is a human conscious notion. It's not a machine notion, right? So you're right, and I think, you know, that's what's fun about stories like that. And I think you're right. We're not too far from having beings like that. But the skeptic in me wants to kind of push the Turing test aside and go, well, you know, that just doesn't settle the issue. I think you're right. The world is going to change very quickly, and we will have these kinds of machines, and they'll be able to pass some modern version of the Turing test.
Yeah.
But will we be able to conclude with certainty from that those beings are conscious? I just don't think so. But before we finish talking about the Turing test, I want to talk a little bit about Turing machines and some of Alan Turing's other contributions to the field of artificial intelligence and computability. And without a doubt, if there's any computer scientists out there in the audience, you're going to be able to speak to this much more intelligently than I am. You know, while I've taught logic and taken graduate level logic courses in computability and whatnot, I feel like in those higher level logic courses, I feel like I barely scraped by, really. And they weren't my main focus in philosophy, but I know enough about them to talk about them a little bit. But Alan Turing's, one of his contributions to the field of computability is the discovery in the proof that any digital computer can emulate any other digital computer. Mm. And he had this concept called a Turing machine after him. And these are really kind of old school computability machines. And some people have tried to build actual physical Turing machines, but they're more like a theoretical computing machine constructed of things like an infinitely long ticker tape and a computer that's able to sort of read and write things onto this ticker tape. You can read something in a certain position, write it somewhere else on the tape, one position over, and so on and so forth, and basically compute very complicated processes one little bit at a time on this infinitely long ticker tape that's passing by. And it has to be kind of infinitely long because there's some computations that require, you know, vastly long, you know, ticker tapes to compute. But so just kind of posit an infinitely long ticker tape as part of this Turing machine. But he basically discovered that anything that can be computed on any kind of digital computing device can be computed on a Turing machine. And that means that anything that's able to do computation in this Turing complete kind of way can be done on any other kind of machine that's able to process information and compute in a Turing complete way. Mm-hmm. Computer languages are synonymous like that. You know, anything that can be done in one computer language, in theory, if the language is Turing complete, can be done in any other computer language. And that's a very nice thing to know if you're interested in computer science and programming. But what's important about this historically, I think, in the philosophical discussion of artificial intelligence, is that there came to be an analogy drawn between digital computers and the human mind. You know, you can imagine if you start thinking, if you're seeing the progress of the development of programming machines and computation machines in the early and mid 20th century, right? All of a sudden, you're getting machines that are able to compute massively complex things that the human brain is just not able to do on its own. So, you know, people who are observing this fact came to think about the human mind in that way. What if the human mind is just a complex type of computing machine? And when they talk about Data as an artificially intelligent being in Star Trek, you often hear them talk about Data in this way. How many cycles per second are you able to compute, Data? How many calculations can you do per second, right? And that is a signpost of Data's intelligence, right? Look how complex he is. Look how many computations he can do per second. He must be intelligent, right? And so the analogy was made, you know, what if the human mind is just a digital computer, a massively complex one? Look how many neurons are in our brain, right? You know, we're talking an order of magnitude more complex, several orders of magnitude more complex than our fastest computers now, right? But in principle, goes the thought experiment here. If the human mind is just a digital computer, a massively complex one, then in theory, any other digital computer should be able to emulate whatever's going on in the human brain and be conscious just like a human brain is conscious. And so you can see this parallel between thinking of our own minds as digital computers and the development of increasingly complex computing machines really kind of bolstered this analogy that Alan Turing is trying to make. The guy who comes up with the Turing test is also the guy who discovered that different types of digital systems are able, in theory, to emulate each other given an infinitely long time period and these ticker tapes and whatnot. You know, there's no fundamental difference between the two. But the assumption there, in order to make that analogy, is that the human mind is essentially a digital computer that can be emulated.
Yeah, in one of the first things that we discover about Data when we meet him in Encounter at Farpoint is Data says to Commander Riker, you know, I am superior to humans in, you know, every way. He said, I would gladly give it up to become human. And of course, you know, Riker says famously to him, pleased to meet you, Pinocchio.
Right.
So we discover, again, science fiction, that Data is superior to humans in every way. So the idea here in the Star Trek universe is that Data has surpassed human ability in terms of his ability to think and act, to compute, to solve a problem, to determine logical in a logical course of action. So in that regard, science fiction, he is superior to humans. So your question is very valid here. You know, at what point, assuming that the human mind is nothing more than a complex computing machine, you know, would we be able to duplicate it in some form or fashion, if you will, in something like a Turing machine? Of course, you know, we find out in Star Trek that even Data's positronic brain is far too complex a thing at that time to recreate. He certainly does so when he creates his offspring, Lau, but then later is unable to prevent a cascade failure in Lau's positronic net. So, you know, back to the essential question, you know, assuming that the human mind is nothing more than a complex calculator, would we be able to simulate that? I don't know the answer to that question.
Well, I guess that goes, you know, if Alan Turing was correct in his proof that you can simulate any digital machine with any other digital machine, then if the mind just is a computer, then that should settle the issue if that assumption is correct, right? Then you could program some other machine that's complex enough to basically emulate, but in a strong substantive sense, emulate in the sense of simulate or be just as good as, you know, the human brain and doing everything the brain does with all the same properties and whatnot. And there's something that just strikes me as a little bit of philosophical sleight of hand here, and we can talk in another episode about different theories. Theories of consciousness, but one of the theories of consciousness is functionalism, the idea that what it means to have certain mental states is just to have a very complex set of input and output conditions. You know, in a certain set of input conditions, you get a certain output. Like, if you stimulate my mind in a certain way, I'm going to experience fear, or I'm going to experience hope, or whatever it is. It's, you can come up with these massively complex functional diagrams of inputs and outputs, just like you have with a digital computer. You know, that's how you specify computer logic. You deal in terms of inputs into the logic system, and it churns away at doing whatever processing it does, and it spits out an output. That's what it means to have a function. So functionalism is one interpretation of consciousness, but it still strikes me as just a little philosophical sleight of hand. I mean, I know for a fact, Mike, that you have more of a dualist bent, right? You believe in a soul. You're a theist,
sure.
And so you are probably not going to be inclined to think that the mind is just a digital computer. And I think the reason is that it leaves out some essential features of what it means to be conscious. Do you want to try to take up the hard question of here? What does thinking of the mind as a digital computer leave out of our picture of consciousness?
Well, I think the operative word here when we're talking about Turing machines is simulation. That I think that's the operative word there. I mean, I believe it's possible to simulate just about anything, because we're intelligent creatures, and given enough time and the proper resources, I think we're capable of almost anything.
You could program that spontaneity in.
Yes, sure. Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And for that matter, let's break this down scientifically. I've watched brain surgery. I think it's fascinating how you are able to stimulate areas of the brain electrically and cause movement. For instance, a little stimulation, electrical stimulation, you can cause a facial tic or the bending of the arm or flexing of the fingers. We know that we can affect mood by altering brain chemistry, and we can do that pharmaceutically.
Yeah, neuroscience has increased at a massive rate in the last several decades. But this isn't even a really a recent phenomenon. Like there are early examples in the history of psychiatry. Like there's a famous case. I wish I could remember it off the top of my head. I'm not a psychiatrist, but a case where a patient was impaled in the brain. They got impaled in the head with a rod and the person survived and had this rod taken out. But it changed their personality massively. Mm-hmm. It changed the person from being a quiet introverted person to an extroverted sharper, harsher kind of person. Just a radical personality change. So they started to realize, hey, look, some of these things we take for granted as being tied to who we are as people, our consciousness, right, is intimately tied up with whatever the heck is going on in the brain.
Yes.
So that actually has steered psychiatry and philosophy away from these dualist positions toward more physicalist positions in one variety or another, whether it's behaviorism, trying to define consciousness just in terms of behaviors, or functionalism in terms of input and output conditions, or even emergent physicalism, where the idea that higher level complex systems exhibit new and novel properties, but they're still physical properties. These are just different ways to try to ensure that when we talk about consciousness and the mind, that we ground it in something physical, and namely whatever's going on inside the brain, and that's been incredibly successful in the 20th and now 21st century. Does that lend credence to the idea that the mind could be simulated completely, or is there still something essential left out of the picture of what it means to be conscious?
Yeah, I think it raises interesting questions, because we have documented evidence that and I think that's probably an extreme case, being impaled through the brain. But any kind of insult to the brain, be it a stroke, I've seen people fundamentally changed, their personalities fundamentally changed as a result of a stroke, an aneurysm, brain surgery. I've seen the personality of people that I've known a lifetime fundamentally change. So I think it raises some very interesting questions about that. But, then we get into the question of, and I think it's the same question that Data was asking Dr. Crusher here in this episode, Quality of Life. At what point did I stop being an assemblage of parts in Dr. Soong's lab and become, a living entity? And isn't that the $1 million, the $64,000 question, as they said? Speaking to, and you're right. I'm a bit dualist. I think you're dealing with matters when we talk about what fundamentally makes a person. I think we're dealing with some theological matters there, but I think there are some interesting questions raised when we think about the fact that, again, chemically, electrically, we can stimulate the brain and produce all kinds of interesting results.
Well, the two things that strike me as difficult or impossible to simulate, and maybe difficult or impossible to fully capture on these more physicalist interpretations of consciousness, I think one thing is consciousness. It's just the idea that not just having behaviors, but there's a self-awareness, basically a subjective experience, you know, what it's like to be me. You know, there's the things I do and there's the behaviors I exhibit and the things I can calculate, right? The things that Alan Turing would be interested in, right? And then there's the subjective qualitative experience, what it's like to be me, right? and that idea that there's not just behavior, there's also subjective consciousness or subjective experience. I have a hard time understanding in any of these positions, that whether it's a digital computer position like Alan Turing had, or any of these other physicalist positions, how something like a self-awareness in the subjective sense, right? You know, the fact that that there's a me and I'm conscious of whatever's happening in my mind, right? And it's not tied to any behavior. And it seems it might be tied to what's going on in my brain, sure. And you can hand wave a little bit about how that works, but it's not definable in terms of these other types of descriptions, you know, the types of things you can calculate or the types of neuron firings that go on in your brain. None of that seems to capture the subjective experience of consciousness. And so I just think that you know, this Turing machine approach, that, you know, thinking of the mind as a digital computer, there might be a fundamental inability for it to capture subjectivity. And you can try to eliminate that. You can just sort of hand wave and say, well, there is no such thing as subjectivity. What that is just whatever's going on inside the brain, right? And some of these theories are eliminativist. They would just they think that talk of consciousness and subjectivity is like spooky metaphysics. It's like talking about ghosts and goblins and spirits and demons. That's a remnant of our more mystical, metaphysical, superstitious kind of worldviews, that as we learn more and more and more about neuroscience, that kind of talk is going to be weeded out of the picture. You know, so I rather than saying I'm sad today, Mike, I might say, hey, Mike, my C fibers are firing today. and that would that convey all the information you need to know what my mental state is? Or is there something important about our talk of subjective experience? And, you know, being a subjective a person who has subjective experiences, just like you are, right? We're conscious. I would hate to see those kinds of descriptions eliminated away. And of course, my wanting it to be the case doesn't make it the case, but it just feels like I have a hard time understanding how those lower level physical descriptions can capture what's going on in the mind. So subjective experience, which is sometimes called qualia, Q-U-A-L-I-A, like quality, the qualitativeness of our experience. You know, like, for example, not just knowing what it's like, knowing about, so like, I'm trying to think of a typical example, like seeing the color red is a good example, right? You know, you can learn everything you want about color, right? You know, how the cones in your eye work, and, you know, different properties of light and whatnot. But that none of that is going to capture the experience of seeing red, right?
Right.
That's just a different quality. There's a qualitativeness to our experience that it feels like those descriptions don't capture. So I look at simulation of the Turing test variety, you know, thinking of the mind as a digital computer. And I just think, you know, they're essentially just eliminating or ignoring the important features of consciousness, which are these qualitative experiences.
Yeah, you know, and it's interesting. You gave the example of, you know, the science of how our eye works compared to experiencing it. And I you know, my mind immediately went to Geordi. And it's interesting because, you know, he has this visor that enables him, in all intents and purposes, to see the world around him in a way that is far superior to say what you or I would be able to see. I mean, he can see, you know, color on a spectrum that we can't see, and heat signatures, and you know, I mean, my goodness, that visor is an incredible piece of technology. Mm-hmm. And yet, you know, I believe it was Insurrection when he his eyes regenerate and he's able to see you know, a sunset. Mm-hmm. And he's talking about the experience of seeing a sunset in the way you and I see it, and there's a certain euphoria to experiencing it in that way that, you know, he just didn't have the satisfaction of seeing multiple sunsets through his visor. And so I think it does come down to something that is beyond mechanical digital capability.
It's funny you mentioned Geordi, because the example I just used of seeing the color red is an example that comes from a thought experiment by the philosopher Frank Jackson, who basically gave a thought experiment very much like this. Imagine you knew all the physical facts about seeing the color red. And then you know, say you grew up in a black and white room and you were instructed in basic physics and the biology of the eye and everything you could possibly know about seeing color. And then, you know, for the first time, you know, the color red is brought into the room and Mary, the protagonist in the story, or in this case, Geordi, right? You know, Geordi gets to see color for the first time. Mm-hmm. Has that person learned something new, or do they already know everything they needed to know? Would you say that they learned something about color vision in actually experiencing the subjective experience of seeing it for the first time, or did they already know everything they need to know just from learning all the physical facts? And so Frank Jackson takes that example to be a counter argument against physicalism. He basically says the character does learn something new, and that shows that physicalism is false. You know, there must be some facts that are not just physical facts.
Yeah. And back to our exocomps, you know, in the episode, they develop an appreciation for their own lives. Mm-hmm. Kind of the main driving plot point in the episode is they recognize the preciousness of life. And so, you know, first of all, they are intelligent enough to be able to see through a bogus experiment. Mm-hmm. But you know, does that meet the Turing test? Yeah, possibly. But does it mean they're alive? I don't know. Evidently, in this episode, what really distinguishes them as living beings is their ability to self-preserve. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the episode, one of those three exocomps makes the ultimate sacrifice, if you will, sacrifices itself in order to save the day.
Yeah, and almost foreshadowing Data's sacrifice in Nemesis.
Indeed it was. Sure. Indeed it was. Might have been his inspiration. I'm not sure, but
yeah, right. When Data's, you know, pointing his phaser at the the Thaleron generator, right? Is he thinking back to the exocomps? You know, this is the best I can do. I'm gonna sacrifice myself for my crewmates.
That would if we could ask Data.
See, now I kind of envision Data as being like suicide. You know, he's ready to pull the trigger at a moment just to prove that he's human.
Nihilistic Data.
Right. Goodbye, cruel world.
Goodbye, cruel world.
Exactly. Well, Mike, the last thing I wanted to talk about here tonight is an objection to this this idea that we can think of the mind as a digital computer and that other digital computers can emulate what's going on in the mind, this Turing test approach to artificial intelligence. And there's a philosopher named John Searle, and he's still alive, and he's a philosopher at Berkeley. And he came up with a very famous example that's supposed to be a counterargument against this computer science-y approach to artificial intelligence. And he came up with an example that is called the Chinese room example, or the Chinese room objection to artificial intelligence. And because this is Star Trek, you know, a Star Trek podcast, we're going to talk about it in terms of Klingon. So this is now the Klingon room objection to artificial intelligence.
I think it's fair enough.
The argument basically goes something like this. Suppose you're in a room and you're not a Chinese speaker. In this case, you're not a Klingon speaker, right? And it's like me. I don't know Klingon. I've never taken the time to learn Klingon. So suppose now I'm put in a room and I don't know how to speak Klingon. And inside this room, there's an instruction manual, basically a correlation guide showing, sort of inputs and output conditions for language. You know, if someone gives you this kind of combination of symbols in Klingon, the proper kind of response is something like this, and it teaches you how to manipulate the symbols and give an output. And so on one side of the room, there's a little door, and people are going to start feeding you things in Chinese, in Searle's example, but feeding you things in Klingon, like passing you pieces of paper with symbols written on it or something to that effect, right? And then you pull out your instruction book and you look up the correlation guide. What's the proper kind of response for this kind of an input, this kind of a statement in Klingon? And you construct your new sentence out of Klingon symbols and pass it out the other side of the door and hand it back to whoever's going to receive it. And suppose you got really, really good at this. Like, language is complicated, right? So at first you might struggle a little bit, and you know you're going to take your time, and you're going to have to look up everything, and you're only going to be able to handle some simple expressions. But over time, as you learn more and more and more about how to manipulate these symbols, you get really, really good at this. Such that no matter how complicated of an expression in Klingon someone hands you into the room, you're able to whip together a response and pass it out the other side of the door, and people are going to be really impressed with whatever you hand to them on the other side of the door. You know, you've constructed such a good Klingon response, with all the Klingon grunts and growls and whatever's involved in speaking Klingon. The question then is, would you say that this person understands Klingon? Or in Cheryl's example, does this person speak Chinese now, right? Do they understand Chinese because they can manipulate the symbols? Or in Star Trek land, would you say that you understand Klingon because you're really good at manipulating Klingon symbols and can fool the people outside the room? And so that is the Chinese room objection. I mean, so you can probably guess what Searle's going to say about that right here in just a minute. But what do you think about that, Mike? You know, if I was really good at manipulating Klingon symbols such that I could really fool you into thinking that I spoke Klingon, or I could fool Worf, who studied all the manuals on being Klingon, would I then be a Klingon speaker?
Well, I guess the question we need to ask is, at the end of this episode, did that nihilistic exocomp shout, "Today is a good day to die"?
In Klingon. Before it.
In Klingon.
The original Klingon.
Yeah, here's the thing, I did a little bit of reading on this because it was a concept, it was an idea that I was unfamiliar with, and the thing that I found fascinating about it is I think it does kind of take a step in a different direction than our Turing test that we've been talking about, in that it requires objective thinking that I don't think I don't believe the Turing test really I don't think it really satisfies.
Well, Searle's argument hinges on the distinction between what he calls syntax versus semantics.
Yes.
Syntax being the sort of the grammatical arrangement of symbols, right? Languages have this, computer programming languages have syntax, right? The things that count as valid arrangements of symbols inside the language, right? That's syntax. And there's a way of manipulating symbols merely syntactically, right? If you literally didn't understand Klingon, and you someone handed you a batch of characters, you looked it up and you learned you were supposed to pass out another a batch of characters as the response. That's a syntactical manipulation of the characters, right? Based purely on the syntax, not on the meaning of the terms involved, right? You can do all of that without understanding any of the actual meaning involved. So by contrast, a semantic understanding would be understanding the actual meaning of the terms, right? If you knew that the terms meant something and referred to something, had connotations and all the things we think of as a rich language, right? That's part of what it means to understand language. And Searle's point is that's part of what it means to have consciousness, right? We understand the meaning of things when we are intelligent and we're conscious. We're not merely manipulating things syntactically insides of our brains, right? We're not just manipulating symbols. We understand the meaning of what those symbols refer to. Mm-hmm. And that's an important part of language, and it's also an important part of consciousness, according to Searle. So he would basically say that in principle, no matter how sophisticated of a digital computer you've got, no matter how good of a positronic brain you've got inside Data, right, that is still a syntactic manipulation of information and not genuine semantic understanding. So Searle, his argument is interesting because he basically grants Turing all of his assumptions, like, digital computers are getting more and more complex. They're going to be able to exhibit all the behaviors that humans do. Searle says, okay, I'm going to grant you all of that. That doesn't mean that there's any actual understanding there. It's still just based on syntactical manipulation of characters, essentially. Massively complex, of course. We're talking about millions or billions or trillions of calculations per second, right? So a massively complex syntactical manipulation of information, none of which is genuine semantic understanding, he thinks. So he thinks that in principle, there is no such thing as artificial intelligence, that artificially constructed beings, digital computers and otherwise, only deal with syntax. They don't deal with semantics. So they will, in principle, never be able to achieve what genuinely conscious biological beings achieve.
Yeah. And the thing I appreciate about that, and I'm not joking around about this, you know, I can recall as a college student, I took Koine, which is, you know, ancient common Greek. And it's a dead language, and there's a really good reason why it's a dead language. It's a very complex language. For instance, the verb that is translated "I loosed," mm-hmm. Which is "luo" in that language, depending on the participle of that particular verb, there are literally dozens of forms of the word. Luo, luai, luam, and luete, luusi. Mm-hmm. Change the participle. It could be luso, lusai, lusete, lususi. So you've got different. You've got the complexity of the semantics there that you know are completely changed. So I appreciate this and understand this particular objection for what it is, and I think it raises an interesting point.
Well, the parallel with Greek is really interesting, and other languages that are heavy on the syntax, like Latin or any inflected mm-hmm. languages sure. that have that deal with manipulating parts of the language based on its grammatical role. Latin is like that. Greek is like that. Most Romance languages are like that. Presumably Klingon is like that. If I took the time to learn Klingon, I'm sure it's got its syntactical rules. But you can get very, very good at constructing sentences in Greek or in Latin without really knowing what you're doing. Mm-hmm. All right, you can learn all the rules and still not be able to understand the sentence in Greek, right? I could learn that this is a noun, and when the noun is in this role, it has this ending on it, and you can learn all of that and put together a perfectly valid Greek sentence, even an interesting Greek sentence maybe, and still have no semantic understanding of what that sentence actually means. Mm-hmm. And Cyril's point is that's all computers do.
Yeah.
They just manipulate information around. They don't actually understand any of it. So then the interesting question to push back on is, well, then how do we do it? How do our brains get semantics? Or in Star Trek land, how does Data get semantics? Or how does in any genuinely intelligent being have semantic understanding? And Searle's point is a little hard to understand. I'm not even sure I fully understand it myself. But he basically says he doesn't think that consciousness is a property of these things like digital computers. It's a consciousness. It's a property of brains, that brains have a certain biological property that, when they're put together in the right way and they've got all their properties, that's just one of their emergent properties of a certain biological organism. But it's not something that can be replicated. You can replicate the syntactical information processing, but you can't replicate the emergent properties that, from what we can tell, only seem tied to actual brains. And there's some validity to that, that when you have complex structures, new properties can emerge out of those structures that you wouldn't be able to predict. So he basically just claims that consciousness is an emergent property of whatever our brains are, but they're properties of brains. They're not properties of other types of things that simulate some of the types of things that brains do, like digital computers.
Yeah, and that's not a very satisfying answer either. I think Searle raises some interesting questions. I think that it definitely takes the litmus test, if you will, for emerging intelligence, kind of the next step. But it doesn't really satisfy, I think, the big question here.
I think he does a good job of laying down what the important things to take into account are, right? He thinks subjectivity and things like qualia are important. And he thinks those aren't captured by a digital computer. So that's a good insight to have, I think. And then you can ask the question, well, how exactly does our brain produce those kind of those kinds of properties, right? If my brain has neurons firing and all the other things that are going on inside my brain, what is the sort of causal connection between this lower level stuff happening in my brain and the emergent properties? But this is one of the things that's really, I think, interesting and frustrating and a little maddening about thinking of emergent properties, that in some sense the emergent properties are new, and they aren't just reducible to the lower level properties, and that what makes them so frustrating and interesting, right? You can get emergent behavior that you can't predict in terms of merely what's going on at the lower level, which means any attempt to try to reduce it to that lower level is going to fail. And we've in the last 50 or 75 years or so in philosophy and in culture and technology, a reductionist approach has been very successful. You can go, you've got a problem with depression. Here, take a pill, right? We mm-hmm. can treat that by focusing on the lower level descriptions. But those higher level properties like consciousness seem to be resist the attempt to describe them in terms of lower level physical properties. So I think, that's one of the defining characteristics of emergent properties is that they're just not reducible. So any attempt to do so is going to be, is going to fail. And so Searle kind of captures this idea that maybe the mind is something that's inherently irreducible, that if you attempt to reduce it to this lower level, it's going to fail and you're going to be dissatisfied by that answer. And then you have to ask, well, it has to work some way, right? And his answer is a little maddening. It basically is, well, that's just what brains do.
Yeah.
And and that's the end of the story. You know, it's not something that digital computers do. It's something that brains do. And it's a different kind of system made of different kinds of stuff with different kinds of properties. So it might be a little, you know, it's not, he doesn't mean to go mystical with it. He's not talking about a soul. He's not talking about dualism. He's talking about an emergent physical property out of whatever complex stuff is going on in our brain that other types of systems like digital computers just don't seem to be able to produce.
Indeed. Indeed. Well, Zachary, any final thoughts?
Well, you know, we focused a lot on different types of different ways of thinking about artificial intelligence and different possible responses. In Star Trek land, I think this is a little frustrating to me. And it's part of the reason I think I don't like this episode very much, because I think the episode, The Quality of Life, just doesn't deal with any of these issues very well. It does deal with the moral issues. Well, if you grant that these exocomps are a new type of life form, then, you know, Data's reaction is really interesting, right? You know, he's in a moral dilemma now. Does he follow the orders of his captain, or does he serve as an advocate for the exocomps? And that's an interesting question. But in terms of answering the question of what life is, or what consciousness is, or whether the exocomps are genuinely conscious, what would it mean for any being, including Data, to be conscious? You know, what makes Data's positronic brain so special that it's able to produce this subjective experience where other types of machines like the console, Worf's console on the bridge, right? We don't think of that as conscious. What's the difference there? This episode doesn't do a very good job of delving into those issues, and frankly muddies it up by conflating the issue of consciousness with the issue of whether the exocomps are alive. So I think the philosopher in me is a little frustrated by the wishy-washiness of the terminology inside this episode. And probably that's part of the reason it's never been one of my favorite episodes. But, I think there's a fundamental division here in terms of philosophy in general, but the philosophy of artificial intelligence. You know, some people are going to fall kind of on the side of focusing on subjective experience and consciousness as a qualitatively different kind of experience that computers or androids or holograms aren't going to be able to capture. Whereas, you know, other people who have more of a computer science-y, mathematical, lower level physics kind of interpretation of the natural world are going to be more inclined to say, well, it doesn't matter what's going on in the brain. We can do that with a digital computer, just like Turing was trying to do. And I think John Searle's got some really good objections there, really thinking about which parts of our understanding are syntactical and which parts are semantic and focusing on the meaning rather than merely on symbol manipulation. You know, that's all really important stuff to take into account. You know, and I think for me, every time I see one of these arguments for artificial intelligence or for a physicalist interpretation of consciousness, I'm always dissatisfied with it because, you know, when I turn inward, just like, you know, if you remember last week when we talked about skepticism of the external world and Descartes' I think, therefore I am argument, this is Descartes' fundamental insight that when you turn inward, there's a subjective experience, what it's like to be you, a certainty about that experience in your own being that is not reducible to any of these other types of things we've been talking about, computers or neurons or otherwise, right? And that subjective experience, I don't understand what it would be like to eliminate that from our vocabulary, so to speak, right? You know, I think that's such a defining characteristic of how I think of myself as a person, how I think of other people. I think some of the creativity that you see in the world is tied to the sense of subjective experience, right? Interpretation and whatnot. And I just think that, you know, I have a hard time seeing how a computer can have that. No matter how complex of a computer you get, even at the level of data, unless data's positronic brain is qualitatively different than a digital computer in some way, right? It's not a digital computer. It's a positronic brain, whatever that means. If that is more like a human brain in some crucial respect, then maybe data does have the subjective experience. But I have a hard time seeing that the exocomps or lower level machines or even massively complex digital computers are able to capture that subjective experience. So I still think of it in terms of simulation. Like when I talk to Siri on my phone, I don't think I'm talking to a person. I think I'm talking to a clever simulation.
Yeah.
I don't know what my 1-year-old niece will think when she grows up, but it'll be, I'll have to ask her in 20 years. But I just don't think that the behavior aspect of artificial intelligence is going to settle the issue like Alan Turing thought it would.
Yeah, agreed. Agreed. Like you, this isn't my favorite episode, but Zachary, it does raise some very interesting questions, and it does so in a way that I think was fresh in some ways for Star Trek, because we had gotten so used to associating artificial intelligence with data being, you know, something in a humanoid form that we could relate to, and now we're back to something that's non-humanoid. Interestingly enough, we see an artificial intelligent character in Voyager Think Tank, I think is the name of the episode, and we don't even really think about that. I mean, we almost dismiss that character. It was some aluminum foil on a wooden
tin
frame.
Foil hat. Yeah, right.
What's that?
It had its tin foil hat.
Tin foil hat. But, right. And we almost dismissed that, but you know, here we have these three exocomps, and we're forced to answer the question: at what point did it cease to be an assemblage of parts and pieces and become, you know, an emerging life? And I think this episode did a brilliant job asking the question, but it fell, I think, very short in its ability to make a case for these exocomps being being alive, if you will.
Where the episode was really brilliant, I think, is in stripping away the non-essentials, right? With Data, there are a lot of non-essentials. The fact that he's in a human-shaped body, that he has replicated biological processes, right? That stuff you can strip away and get to the heart of the question. In principle, can a machine have consciousness? And just by putting the being in question in a different shaped object strips away a lot of the non-essentials and lets you focus on the machine aspect of it. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, Dr. Fairlawn kept referring to the exocomps as tools. Mm-hmm. And, of course, you know, we tend to look at her as being very, you know, unenlightened because she couldn't, you know, Data seems to be the only one who can see that these are emerging life forms, and he's going to, you know, sacrifice his captain and everybody else in the Enterprise to, I think his reaction was a bit over the top. In the way that he was advocating for, you know, for the exocomps. But we walk away feeling like, you know, Dr. Fairlawn was very unenlightened. And it's kind of a picture, if you will, of darker chapters of our own human history when, men tend to look at other people who didn't look like them or speak like them or dress like them as being...
As
being tools. And...
Well, this speaks to the heart. You remember, if you think back to our episode we did on, I think it was episode 6 on consequentialist ethics versus deontological ethics. This is one of the defining characteristics of Kantian or deontological ethics. Is for Kant, it was always wrong to treat other intelligent beings, other sentient, self-aware, rational beings as means to your own end. In other words, don't treat other beings as tools. And that's exactly what's going on here in the episode. So calling the exocomps tools really raises the ethical stakes, because now you're just outright violating some of these basic tenets of Kantian morality of not of respecting other autonomous beings as rational autonomous beings, just like you are, and not treating them as a means to your own ends. And that's just outright wrong and on Kant's moral philosophy. So we did, while that's not the focus of the episode, that, you know, I think that's one of the brilliant features of this episode of TNG, is just by calling the exocomps tools, you know, the moral stakes all of a sudden become very high.
Yeah, indeed. So, you know, we basically answer the question at the end of this episode, you know, because they have free will, if you will. Mm-hmm. And there's a blast from our past going all the way back to, you know, episode 2 of Metatrex. If our listeners would like, if they haven't heard that particular episode, that discussion was a two-part discussion, episode 1 and episode 2. Go back and give that a listen. But we basically, at least in the context of quality of life, we're answering the question, you know, are these exocomps alive by attributing to them free will? And that seems to be the answer. And again, it falls a little short for me, and my limited philosophical understandings. It just falls short. A great question, and I think it's one that we'll dig into more as we go along. Because again, we have some really great episodes here that deal with questions of artificial intelligence and what does it mean, you know, to be an emerging life form. But for me, quality of life asked some really great questions and fell very short in answering those questions. Evidently, in order to be alive, you have to be able to grow a beard. I don't know, but. I think the discussion was great today.
Or at least replicate one.
At least be able to replicate one in the mirror universe. It's been fun talking about the problem of artificial intelligence in the Star Trek universe. But listeners, this isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week. So here's a quick look at some other things you might have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
Usually Mike and I are like,
what's going on? Our heads are just spinning like, what? I don't understand what's going on, you know? And, like, you know, when I listen to that, I'm like, are we, like, you know, bad?
The Orb.
He requested, you know, a Bajoran officer to serve with him on purpose, you know. He understands. You make this their own. We can't.
I'm glad he did it on purpose. I could see him, like, accidentally requesting a Bajoran officer. Oh, man, I checked the wrong box on the form. Damn.
The Ready Room.
Actually, I think at this point, Vulcan Love Slave was probably just a short story, right? It hadn't been turned into a full-blown
That's right. It's not a full-blown novel at that point. Yeah,
it's
yeah.
just fanfic. It's just fanfic.
Yeah, just fanfic. Right.
Just on the internet. People started writing after First Contact there in Montana.
To the journey! It's very much the genesis of Seven of Nine.
Genesis alone is not. Sorry.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
So we're closing in on the World Series is what you're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of course, the Sox were able to win the World Series in, you know, 12 games. So we're no White Sox, but we're like the Cubs or something. Oh, no, wait, they didn't win the World Series. Never mind.
The 602 Club.
To speak back to the lightsaber overall, I mean, it was practical reasons that they switched it to green, but I've always loved the fact that Luke had that green saber, even when I was a kid. Like, it's really cool. It's an immediate visual signal, you know, even outside of the outfit that he's wearing, that he's a different kind of person than even we saw in the previous film. And I really like that.
Literary Treks.
The pinnacle of episode that we've ever done on that was probably when we had Tristan from To the Journey on to talk about some Voyager comics. And we ended up, that show was named Tuvok's Remedial School for Badasses or something of that nature. So, I mean, yeah, these old comics can just be very, very fun.
Meta Treks.
I looked it up, and ornare is the Latin word for to adorn.
That's fascinating.
So I looked up breca, and it turns out the same spelling, B-R-E-K-K-A, is Old Norse for slope or hillside.
And that, listeners, is something you will only get right here on Metatrex.
Better living through etymology.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these and other shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly, and it makes it easier for other listeners to find the shows as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. Another way you can help us keep all our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels along with all the incredible perks that we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on our content development team, and many, many more. Hey, we really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. And don't forget to check out Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society that will design and launch an 8-foot orbiter and return the craft to Earth. The NSS Enterprise orbiter will carry more than 100 student-designed science experiments into space, and you can help make it happen. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. If you'd like to contact us with feedback or suggestions for our show, or to send us your thoughts on anything that we discussed in this episode of Metatrex, you can contact us in several different ways. There's a form that you can grab at our website, trek.fm/contact.
To leave us a voicemail, you can look in the sidebar on our show page or go to speakpipe.com/trekfm.
You can find us on Twitter. Our handle is @trekfm.
You can also find us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/trekfm. And on Facebook, be sure to join us in the Babel Conference. That's Trek FM's listener group. To find the Babel Conference, just go to the search bar on Facebook, type Babel, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field, and it'll come right up. And it's a closed group. It's just for Trek FM listeners. So be sure to hit the join button, and someone will let you right in. And you can join us there to talk Star Trek and philosophy with us.
We'd also like to invite you to leave a rating and review of Metatrex on iTunes. We'd love to hear your feedback and suggestions for the show. We want to remind you that we're in the last few days of our promotion, so be sure and leave that star rating, write us a review, and we'll put your name in a hat for the big drawing after January 15th for the Trek FM hoodie coming from the Trek FM store at trekfm/store. Well, Zachary, when you're not advocating for the rights of Exocomps, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs?
Well, like I mentioned before, you can find me in Trek FM's listener group, the Babel Conference, if you want to talk Star Trek and philosophy with me there. And you can also find me on Twitter. My handle is just my name, Zachary Fruhling. That's ZacharyFruhling. And Mike, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs these days?
As always, I'm on Facebook as well as the Babel Conference on Twitter. You can find me. My Twitter handle is @CMichael1701. We'd also like to take a moment to acknowledge the rest of the Metatrex team from the network. Specifically, we'd like to thank C. Brian Jones, founder and publisher of Trek FM, executive producer Charlene Schmidt, Matthew Rushing, and Norman Lau, Aaron Harvey, our art director, content manager Will Nguyen, production manager Richard Marquez, our fabulous editor and producer Dennis Costello. Well, thanks for listening to Metatrex, a Star Trek philosophy podcast, everyone. Until next time, when we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before.